Welcome to the Maris Review. I am really thrilled to be joined today by Joanne Beard, who is just a hero to me. Joanne Beard is the author of the groundbreaking collection of autobiographical essays, The Boys of My Youth, and the novel In Zanesville. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker, Tin House, Best American Essays, and other magazines and anthologies, and she teaches writing at Sarah Lawrence College. Her latest collection is called Festival Days. So happy to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to start by just saying that Festival Days is a collection, and it's one in which essays and short stories live together side by side, and we're not sure which ones are stories and which ones are essays. Tell me about putting out this collection and blurring that line.
Well, it's a culmination of about 20 years of my work. All of the essays that I've written since The Boys of My Youth, and a couple of, I'll call them long short stories that I've written in that amount of time too. Of course, over that 20 year span of time, I also worked on and published a novel in Zanesville. So essentially, you know, I just realized at some point, because of my friend Alice pointed it out to me, that I probably had enough pages that I could make a third book. And so I just started putting together everything that I had written and published since The Boys of My Youth. And I had enough pages to make a book. So it doesn't, so it's a hybrid. It has two pieces of fiction that are very long pieces. It has the title essay, which is kind of a stream of consciousness, kind of different, a little different kind of writing for me. It has some craft essays that I wrote because as a teacher, I was thinking about those issues all the time. And you know, giving talks about that. So it has that, and then it just has some researched pieces that I did out of curiosity and interest, and that's the subject matter of those pieces.
We were talking about before we started recording that this collection in particular goes to those places where I try not to think about the moments of great duress and life-changing, terrible, vulnerable moments that I try to only think about at 3 a.m. if I'm feeling really bleak. And you go there and you make us watch and see and listen.
Well, it's funny when, and I'll talk about it in terms of nonfiction or the essay form, that if you write personal essays, You're really not intending to write about yourself. You may use your own personal experience to launch the piece, but truly what you're trying to do is make some kind of meaning or sense out of something that's more universal than it is personal. And so when you sit down to write a personal essay, typically you're casting around in your mind for the things that are pivotal moments in your life or events that had a kind of life-changing aspect to them. Like in the Werner essay, Werner's experience in the fire, I think, actually caused his life to take a certain kind of turn internally and maybe externally, but most important, I think, internally. And so those pivotal moments are the moments that a writer wants to explore. And so it may seem as though I or my fellow, you know, students and published nonfiction writers really dwell in the dark places. It's not because we like that. It's because that's where the darkest places are the ones that need to be illuminated.
And this is a small spoiler, but when I read the essay, Werner, I had to Google him. You put him in the middle of this life-changing moment in which his life is in danger and he's jumping out of a building that is on fire to save his life. And I couldn't bear the suspense.
Yeah. No, you know, I didn't have to deal with that because I heard Werner's story as he told it to me and to other people, you know, around a dinner table. So in hearing the story, I knew that Werner had not only survived it, but that Werner is a really dazzling human being in a lot of different ways, and deep and profound and, you know, physically super robust. So I had all of that in front of me while I was filtering the story of what happened to him into my own consciousness. So I can imagine Googling him and going, just going, whew, okay, he survived. And not only did he survive, but he thrived.
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you talk, you write about the joy of recounting other people's memories in this book. And I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit more.
Well, sure. And what I was saying before, as mainly a personal essayist, and I don't know why I call myself that, but that's what I strive toward, and that's what I like to read. But as that, sometimes it does feel solipsistic, if I'm using that word right, to be buried inside your own head and to be fetishizing your own experiences. And I have not had a life, you know, I haven't gone to war-torn places. I just haven't had a life where my experiences are worth dwelling on that long. So to be able to slide mentally and emotionally into somebody else's story for a year or two or three and be relieved of that job of kind of mining my own life felt in both cases like a real miracle to me, and really enjoyable and relaxing and exciting.
And there are, I assume, moments when he was in intense shock in this process and going through just terrible trauma, and yet you are able to imagine what was happening in real time to him.
Yeah, by the time I met Werner, I'm going to say maybe a decade had gone by for him since the events and his telling them. And he had been able to process a lot of what happened, just, you know, the way we process trauma, like by remembering it, by telling the story, by getting interested in aspects of it and imagining them for himself and sort of exploring the science of it. And he was really able to explain to me a lot of stuff about what happens to human beings in those kind of traumatic moments, like explaining the kind of brain chemistry that happens when everything slows down and the world rushes in and you feel like you can linger inside a moment for a very long time. I mean, this happens to people, I think, when they get in car wrecks or anything, mm-hmm. that time seems to expand. And Werner really understood why that was and explained it to me. And he did most of the work for me, really, by living it, you know?
And time both expands and contracts in your collection in a variety of different ways. Tell me about the moments that are out of time or that time is not straightforward.
Well, I'm not super aware of it. And I'm not even asking, but I don't know if you mean in the Werner piece or in various other pieces, if you mean it like a craft question, like in a particular essay or story, how do you move back and forth in time without confusing, first of all, yourself, and second of all, the reader? I'm assuming that's the question that I'll answer. And I have to say that for me, I do it automatically without thinking about it. But that only works if you've somehow forced yourself to go deep enough into the piece that it's happening in your head in a kind of fluid way while you're writing it. And if you've done that, somehow, if it's coherent for you, the person who's imagining it, it will generally be coherent for the reader. Because we can follow any story, and I'll go back to the Werner idea, like Werner telling his story at the dinner table that time that I heard it, and everybody being rapt. And nobody has trouble following what somebody is saying in a conversation, because we suspend our confusion because we know that we're going somewhere, and along the way it's going to become clear to us. And so if you do that as a writer, just put a little toehold here and a little handhold there for the reader, they generally can follow you wherever you go. And if they can't, somebody in the early stages of reading it will say, you know what, right at this moment, I got confused. You need to give me a clue where I'm at. Or they will say, you shouldn't have given me that clue. You know, I already knew where I was. So I guess that's the point when early readers are really helpful to a writer.
Right. And I do love that in the middle of these really big essays, there are these smaller craft essays that it was exactly what I wanted when I got there. Like, how did she do that? And then you have a couple of pages to talk about how the writing leads you, or how words become images, become memories, and how they're all connected.
I'm glad it worked that way for you, because it is kind of, I don't know, there might be something slightly arrogant about that I didn't intend, but I know that my readership is writers. You know, people, because I've been in the teaching world for so long that my community is really students and former students and other writers who are posing as academics. So the idea that I would be explaining anything to any of them about craft is sort of arrogant. But the fact is, we're all interested in it.
Yes.
I think we're all interested in it. So I'm glad it felt that way to you. And I'm glad I got to put those pieces in there, because along the way, by including those pieces, I also got to showcase my ducks and think about them. And yeah. I got to think about my father in Alaska all those years ago. And so those craft essays were super pleasurable for me to immerse myself into. So
you have a line about your father in Alaska about the seals. Some things belong only to the people who are experiencing them. And by people, I also mean seals. And that's such a lovely encapsulation of how you write animals.
Yeah. Well, I've never been able to reconcile the fact that my poor father, who adored animals, had to witness that baby seal kill. But I mean, I don't think he minded. I think he felt like it was a privilege to be able to see something like that. But he certainly knew that I wouldn't be able to take it, that, you know, that would not be something I could sit through. I can't even sit through a violent, you know, TV show. So he knew better than to let me watch that. But I do believe that, by the way. I do believe that that there are things that are too private for other people to witness. And the final moments of life, I think, probably qualify as that.
And yet, in Sherry, you took us there.
Yeah, good point. Good point. Yeah, I did that. And I took us into her most private final moment. But just to be really clear, that was That was my version of her final moment. That was not her version of it. We have no idea what happened to her in that moment. And, you know, again, that goes back to the arrogance of the writer. Like the feeling, because I immersed myself so deeply in her story, somehow the unfair feeling that her story belonged to me in that moment. And I guess I stand by having written it because it felt so important to me to do it at the time. But I don't know that would make her very happy. And I don't know that it was perfectly an ethical thing to do.
Hmm. Have her daughters read the piece?
Well, I know her daughter Sarah has, and I'm pretty sure her other daughter, Katie, has read it also. And I think that Sarah liked it, you know, but I'm pretty sure that both of them, and I won't speak for them because I can't really, but my instinct is that they recognized the experience, but they didn't necessarily recognize their mother in that piece. So I never met Sherry. So right. I was truly imagining my way into it. Again, the writer's arrogance. And their version of their mother is so different and so vivid and so personal and so attuned to who she was as a human being and also as a mother in a way that I never could have known her.
Yeah. And she, of course, adopts a puppy in the middle of dealing with her terminal cancer. And I just see this juxtaposition in so many of the pieces in here and in Boys of My Youth.
Yeah, well, Sherry's situation, I'll just interject this, is that she thought that she was through the cancer. Mm-hmm. And she moved back to Iowa to start this whole new different phase of her life. And as you know, as the proud owner of a pug that you adopted, at age 8, I have to say, that you know that sometimes bringing an animal into your life is like the most expansive thing you can ever do. And it's the most hopeful thing you can do, not just for yourself, but for the dog. And so there was Sherry with this shimmering image of hope in the form of this black lab Ursa. And then what happens is she finds out that, you know, hope is gone. But hope wasn't gone for Ursa because she went to live with Sarah after Sherry died.
It was funny to read this collection while still in quarantine because I realized just how much my dog's presence has in my life now. Like, you know, there's no going out anymore. There's no going away. So like we are each other's every day. And sometimes I feel like pets don't get that much cred for being like there.
No, it's true. And I think about all of these dogs, like I always think of New York City apartments where people would go to work and they would be gone for 9 hours and the dog would be in the apartment for 9 hours. And then you come home and it's like, you assume that that's when the dog's life begins. But actually the dog's life has been going on all day in that apartment. And so you always think like, you know, this is no life for a dog. And yet, if you, like me, have done dog rescue and you've walked into the shelters in the city or in, you know, Westchester, which is where I did it, and you see the dogs in the cages, you realize that a dog living in an apartment in New York is actually an unbelievably privileged, wonderful thing. So it's all, you know, your perspective and the circumstances. But it is funny during the pandemic, like our dogs just sit around all day and stare at us and move from room to room as we move from room to room.
Yeah.
We just go, okay, I guess, Oh, you're coming in here. I guess I'll come in here too, and I'll sleep in here. And then we'll go in the other room and I'll sleep in that room.
Yeah. And one of the things that I like to do often is imagine my dog's interior life, which is, you know, one of the things that I love about your writing so much. That even like in the story of the Tomb of Wrestling, the protagonist is fighting off an intruder. She's in real fight or flight mode. And then her dogs are kind of off having their own adventure for a while.
Yeah, they're clueless. They're doing what dogs do. You know, they're going about dog business, part of which is sleeping. But it's funny, my partner always says to me, because we live out in the country and our dogs have about 5 acres that's enclosed that they can hang out in. And I still find a way to like fret about or get involved with what they're doing out there. Like I'll hear them barking, or I think, oh no, they have something cornered out there. And he always says to me, why are you getting involved in dog business? Like he trusts that they can do whatever they need to do out there. And I always think I need to be involved in dog business. Like whatever it is, I have slight control issues, I admit it. Whatever it is, I want to know what they're bothering out there. And so in that story, they're bothering things. Like the dog Spock is bothering a possum that's climbed up on top of the outhouse. We have an outhouse here, an ancient outhouse that is based on. And then the other dog, Pilgrim, is just like walking around, you know, basically checking his posts to make sure everything's okay and where it should be. And obviously keeping an eye on where the groundhog might be, which is what our dogs do too. And they also have an invisible fence as well as a real fence.
And while all this is going on in the story, the details in this one in particular kind of killed me. Like the intruder is eating either a Kraft single or a knockoff of a Kraft single. We don't know which one it is in the kitchen. And there's that inherent shame of having that processed cheese, even as she's been beaten half to death and is plotting how and if she should hurt this man, kill this man.
Well, it's like when you're writing, you know, that the things that really weld something into your memory are the tiny details, the tiny vivid visual details. And I guess for her in that moment, she was experiencing the same thing as the actor in the story, as I was the writer of the story. So she was seeing that thing that he was taking out of the refrigerator, and it was vivid for her in that moment.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about writing Festival Days, the long short story novella, and how that kind of stream of consciousness writing differs from what you've done in the past, and why it's a departure for you.
Well, I wrote it with my friend. We write together. I mean, we write separate pieces, but we go on vacation every year for 2 weeks during spring break. And then usually for the rest of the year, we write at a distance. We call each other on the phone. We talk about what we're working on. We hang up and we write for, you know, a period of time. And then that we clock for ourselves, and then we talk again after we've written and read to each other what we've written. So that piece was, I guess, maybe written over the course of a couple years, maybe 3 years actually. And and every section of it was read to her. and was written in this fast writing way that we do where we, you know, we go, okay, we're going to hang up, talk to you in 30 minutes. And then we hang up and we just write for 30 minutes. And then we talk again and read to each other what we've done. So I was just in this mode of kind of sitting down and writing whatever came to mind. But of course, the story instantly became about my friend Kathy Rich. And so each time I sat down to write, I would sort of gather that story inside my head and fuse it with kind of just whatever was happening in that moment in my chair as I was looking out the window. And it was a really fun process, by the way, really, really fun. And, you know, it just kept accumulating pages and accumulating pages. And then at the end, you know, I had to like write toward an ending. So I did that.
And so the threads have to come together.
They really do. That's the only way it works. So that's the hard part, you know, but at the same time, if you've done that writing thing where every single time you've sat down, you've fully imagined it, you've pushed yourself to remember and create details, those details in themselves start to weave together and create a layer of story in there that you can use to make your ending.
I love that. Before we go, I imagine that there are a lot of writers who will be listening to this podcast, and I was hoping you could talk about the difference or the distinction between art and craft as you write in one of the interstitial essays on craft in the book.
Well, I don't remember what I said about art and craft, but I'm going to think about what that means to me now. I think that it's through the craft. It's just like what I was just saying, okay? So I'm going to try to piece it together in my mind that if you've gone deep enough and you've found these sort of vivid, throbbing, shimmering images that tell your story for you, if you've done that, then that's craft. But it also becomes the art. That's it. So what it requires is that every time you sit down to write, you have to push yourself to that really profoundly deep place where you're not yourself, but you are, as E.B. White says, simply a recording secretary. You're just writing down what you see, and you have to be able to see it. Otherwise, it doesn't live in the minds of the readers.
Thank you. That's wonderful. Do you have a time to do a book recommendation or two?
Well, you know, I just finished reading a book that I really love, which is the book called The Copenhagen Trilogy. So I'll say that because I really liked it and I found it really strange and beautiful. And actually, it kept coming up in my mind when we were just talking because every time you say something about craft that's definitive, like what I just said that was definitive, you discover that somebody can make beautiful, shimmering art that betrays everything that you've just said. And I think the Copenhagen Trilogy does that. It's like what she does is, I can't put my finger on it, but it's not what I do. And it's not what I just was describing. So for that reason, I think it's really, really interesting to me as a writer to read it, but also as a reader, it's just like a kind of a joyous romp. So I'll say that. And then I'll say this book that I really love that I read from time to time, just because I like things that are, that push the boundaries in a certain way. Okay. So this is a writer named Daniel Orozco, and he has a book that's called Orientation, which is a collection of short stories. And I mean short because it's a thin book, but I like thin books because frequently thin books are really, they're deceptive. So I'm going to recommend that book, Orientation by Daniel Orozco.
I'm going to order that right now.
Go for
it. Thank you so much. This is such a pleasure.
Thank you so much. It was really a pleasure for me too. So you take care.
Thank you for listening to the Maris Review, and check the show notes for the books we discussed on here today. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.